Hello, this is Jan Desper-Peters, and I am your host of the BTST Services podcast, Meeting You Where You Are. I am great today. I hope that you're feeling great. We are in the midst of this pandemic, and we are making the best of it. And the world keeps spinning, even though we are in a pandemic. And we want to just share information that's going to meet you where you are. We hope that you will embrace the information that we give. Unlike some sources, we rely on science. We rely on historical facts. And we just tell the truth. We tell it like it is at BTST Services. And so today, I am excited to share with a friend of mine who I have not had the opportunity to see in a while. But when I thought about this topic, he was the first person that came to my mind. And when I called him about it, he shared with me that he was just in the middle of writing his thoughts as it related to this particular topic. And so today, I want to introduce you to my friend, Dr. Kevin Washington. We are going to be talking about a topic that is very timely and relevant, but also very painful. As a mother of two black sons, I am especially pained by what goes on in our society as it relates to the lynching in 2020 of our black men. So what we do know is that social media has recently been flooded by a video showing the tragic killing of a young black 25-year-old, Ahmaud Arbery. He was a former high school football standout, and the video shows him being shot and killed on February 23rd, a Sunday afternoon, while he was jogging in a suburban neighborhood in Georgia. He was immediately accosted by two men, a father and a son, 30 years difference in their age. The father is a former law enforcement officer. And moments later, after they came upon him, shots rang out. A struggle ensued and shots rang out, and Mr. Arbery was killed. The case probably didn't get as much attention as it should have in the very beginning, because of all of the pandemic episodes that we're going through right now. But about 74 days later, a video surfaced. And once this video surfaced, the case sparked yet another conversation and outrage and protests and march about racial profiling and the interpretations of state self-defense laws. And thanks to that outcry of social media, both Gregory and Travis McMichael have been charged with murder and aggravated assault. So to talk to us today about his thoughts, and I'm going to tell you why he's the perfect person to talk about this. First of all, I want to say that I met Mawada maybe 4 or 5 years ago when I was at another organization. We curated a conference and he was our keynote speaker. And I said, that black man is one of the smartest people I've ever seen in my life. And I've got to be his friend. He is an African-centered psychologist. He's licensed in Florida and Washington, D.C. He's an academician, a pastor, a percussionist, and he served as behavioral health consultant to a number of organizations, TV One, Essence, Black Entertainment, TV News. And he also is a proud graduate of not one, but two HBCUs. He also has been the past president of the Association of Black Psychologists. And he is a highly sought after specialist and speaker in these areas. So without further ado, I would like to introduce to you my friend, Dr. Kevin Washington. How are you doing, Kevin, in this pandemic situation?
I am doing well. This is actually a wonderful time to recalibrate, to get things in order. And as a matter of fact, you see, this is my COVID-19 rugged look. I am not doing anything. I'm sheltered in place, getting work done. Right. So I think that we really need to take these moments just to really recalibrate and get ourselves reorganized so that we can recommit ourselves to the real purpose of why we even here on earth, right? So this is that moment.
Kevin, let me pause for a second because my dog is barking. I need to move her. Okay, so I'd like to introduce to you my friend, Kevin Washington. And I'm excited that we get the opportunity to talk today, Kevin, about this very important topic. And I'd like to ask you, first of all, how are you doing in this shelter in place environment? Are you used to working from home?
You know, I'm enjoying this moment to recalibrate, to recommit myself to really why I am here on earth doing whatever I'm supposed to be doing. I enjoy the moments, the solitude where I'm not having to rush and rumble off to someplace. I do miss interacting with people,
right?
In large part. However, I honor this time. And sometimes we have the universe to slow us down to really figure out what's important to us. And I think that all of these issues, these events that are occurring from the pandemic to the topic that we're going to discuss today, is really having us to ask the question of why am I on earth in the first place? And so we are called to do something. It's not really simple to sit around and to occupy space, but really have been called to honor a profound mission. And so that's what I'm using this time for, to really get in touch with my mission for this part of my life.
That's great. I mean, I think that's a great segue into what we're talking about. And I'm hoping that people will take that as a template, as a guide, that you don't necessarily have to write, you know, the world's best novel or to solve society's ills during this pandemic. Mm-hmm. But I'm hoping that people will take this time to sit back and reflect. I don't believe that in my lifetime I'll ever get an opportunity like this again, where I'm not, as my mother would call it, ripping and running.
Ripping and running. That's it. Ringing and twisting.
Right, right. Where I'm not ripping and running, going here, there, everywhere. That's where right. I'm actually able to sit down and listen. I mean, there's so many. I mean, you're probably around my age, but when I was in college, we didn't have the internet.
No.
And so I'm still, you know, 30 years later, very, very amazed at the internet. There's so much information there, so much to do that you don't have to binge watch Netflix. There's so much really good information there.
That's right.
And so today, as I said before, the purpose of our podcast is really to bring people information. And as a person who has worked in the African-centered psychology space and worked with Black people, especially Black men, I'd like to hear your thoughts on the case that I outlined earlier.
You know, when we look at how you couch the conversation around your sons and a lynching, I think that it's critical to understand the psychological traumatic experience that we encounter as a people. We recognize that this is a re-traumatization experience, and how quickly you could draw upon the experiences of lynching, and yet you were not in a situation, I'm guessing, where there was lynching occurring, but you know the narratives, you know the stories. And so Diaz and Rezla have this study that they've done where mice inherit the trauma of their parents. So these mice would be shocked and they would get this whiff of orange blossom. And so they associated the orange blossom smell with the shock trauma. And so as a result, when they would get the whiff of the orange blossom, their bodies would have this visceral response to being shocked. These mice would have pups that would get the smell of the orange blossom, but no shock. And their bodies would show the same visceral response. These pups would grow up and they would have pups. They would have offspring and they would have the same experience. So we see then that in mammals, the capacity to pass down trauma three generations is real. So right. When we talk about the experience that you said occurred around the context of looking at Ahmaud Arbery and being shot and your son, you are not only looking at the contemporary phenomena of it, but you're dealing with the issue of the transgenerational trauma that exists. And so it is a re-traumatization experience that you encounter, that I encounter as well, right? And so the blatant disregard for humanity that ties into this, that how could individuals, after having engaged in this process, as you said earlier, live freely for 74 days. Let's look at this. 30 days is a month. So we're saying then that they were able
over 2 months.
Over 2 months, they were able to exist and to thrive and to do what they were doing. Now the question becomes, why? Why were they protected? That there was definitely a murder that took place, and what protected them from actually having to answer to the call of murder? And so we look at George Bornhill's response. The district attorney says that he saw no wrongful act there, right? How can you not see a wrongful act, right? And so the issue is that it is not only the trauma of being shot, but is the remembrance of perpetually being dehumanized and being devalued as a people.
Right. So I'm a forensics. In another life, I probably would be a forensic psychologist. I love forensics. I watch every show that's related to crime and forensics. And one of my favorites is Law and Order, Special Victims Unit. And one of the things that they have said over the last, I don't know how many seasons they've been in, 20 something, is that the worst thing you can do is villainize the victim. And even, we have grown accustomed over the last 3 years to not really have minimal expectation of decency for the person that's in top leadership of our country. Mm-hmm. And so when you see where in our country, first of all, there is a presumption of innocence until proven guilty. But to continue to have or carry out a narrative that tries to villainize this young man, is incredulous to me. That this person would, say, well, he was in this house that was being built, and that he was a thief, or he was stealing, or they thought he was stealing. I mean, how many of us have been? I mean, I know people who that's what they do. They go around to new developments. They want to see model homes. It's something that they see. And so this young man apparently, had run through this neighborhood before, was curious about this house being built. That's all I saw on the video, looked around and left. And then our nation's top leader is talking in relationship to, yes, I extend my prayers and thoughts to the family, but there's a space in the tape that we can't see. What else is there that needs to be seen? This man was hunted down and killed. And we have to move beyond thoughts and prayers and marches, as far as I'm concerned. I'd like to hear your thoughts about that.
When you mentioned hunted down, it is clear that it was an ambush. The individuals moved, drove down past where he was running, right? So let's be clear. When we watch the tape ourselves, we see the video. We see that he runs into them, which means they would have had to have passed by him. Wow. And to set up shop in front of him to be prepared to accost him. That's a reality. That's not anything that you can make up. But on tape or off tape or recording, it doesn't matter. That's very clear because they were ahead of him. If he had actually engaged in the house behind him, then how did you get past him to be in front of him to set him up, right? So that's the first part of the conversation. Second thing is, who's videotaping?
Right, exactly.
Right, so why is this person behind him? What is your best interest in the process? Right, so we can clearly see that there was a concerted effort and a concern to engage in a process to do harm to someone, right? And so why would you even go armed? I mean, the real issue is, if somebody is jogging, what is the likelihood that they are strapped and jogging? I'm not quite sure how I can trot and carry, even in a concealed carry situation. It would be very cumbersome to run and not have the firearm do something wherever I could conceal it. So there was a known fact that we could assume that the young man was not carrying. The other part of the story is that you mentioned that there was a 30-year difference between Gregory McMichael and his son Travis. Trevor McMichael, or Trevor, one of those words, Travis or Trevor, that he was
Travis.
There we go. Mm-hmm. They were already in position to engage in something, but Gregory McMichael had been in law enforcement. And so what not only what they did is that they also drug up content from Ahmad's high school and said that in high school, he was on probation because he had brought a weapon on campus. The mm-hmm. other caveat to this is that Gregory McMichael had been a part of that investigation. The other piece of this is that Barnhill's son was a part of the prosecution as well for that process. And so that's why they had to recuse themselves from the entire engagement. Now, this means then that what you just said earlier about villainizing the victim, mm-hmm. that there is a drudging up of past experiences. And then also, I think in 2018, 2019, Ahmad was violated probation because of shoplifting. Now, this content comes up only after this shooting takes place. Now, the question is, did you know this when you saw him in the house? And the answer is no. You just found content and substance from past behavior. So here then is the idea of villainizing the victim, and this is beyond the tape. But it does not excuse the process of individuals setting up to ambush a black man who sought to run around them. Because if you watch him, a young man, as he approaches the truck, he's attempting to navigate the truck. He says, well, if I go left, he's there. So I'm going to go to the right where the person did not get out of the truck. And the person came around in front of the truck to approach him. So at that point, he has to do something. And so he's trying to stop the person from shooting him with the gun, right? And this is a reality that we have to be able to engage in. That is that there was an ambush. And the second part of this, which is what I mentioned earlier, that there was protection for this particular behavior. And the question becomes why? Because it is not the first time that it has happened. This is a historical process that we have encountered as African people in this country are perpetually being hunted down and slaughtered in the streets because of the fact that we have no real value outside of serving someone else's benefit. And so that's the critical issue. That's the psychological break that we have.
Right, right. So you said so much. I want to circle back to a couple of things. One is that the whole valuing of Black life and this whole movement that was started after the Trayvon Martin and others were in the same kind of scenario slaughtered. And so just want to talk about for a moment this whole concept of a fear of Black people, especially Black men, as a reason for this disregard for human life, as if, you know, they, you know, just aren't worthy, or I am justified because I have this fear, even though there is no clear and present danger, right? But because I have this fear from, you know, the way I have been taught, the way I have been reared, you know, maybe some of my experiences, that I can then, you know, shoot down, kill a Black person because I have fear.
Right. So how does this narrative become a part of the reality of a population? This narrative of the fear of the Black man, I think about right now, Public Enemy, Fear of the Black Planet, mm-hmm. which ties into Dr. Francis Cress Welsin's conversation about fear of genetic annihilation by whites, which means then that they suggest that anytime a male enters into a white woman, the product is no longer white. And so they fear being genetically annihilated, which may tie into this conversation at some level. However, what I will suggest is that the narrative becomes played out because of a perpetual retelling of this conversation of a group that is violent, that is out to get them, that is the aggressor, but it's really an act of a projection, that they are projecting their own insecurities onto Black men. Think about this. How many townships, how many riots started in this country alone because of some white woman suggesting that she was looked at Emmett Till, she was approached, Rosewood, that somebody was bumped into, Tulsa, Oklahoma, that created a situation where there was a riot because of a black man having some kind of relationship with a white woman, right? So this is their narrative. And so if you look at even their iconography, their narrative, look at King Kong. The idea behind King Kong was this big black brute that wanted to ravage the little damsel in distress. Let's be real for a moment, right? If there was some type of sexual proclivities that King Kong had towards this woman, what could he do with the woman that he's putting in his hand? Nothing. So in reality, it was an absurd discourse, but it is a part of their perpetual conversation of this black person being the brute, because it can annihilate them. Not only can it annihilate them physically, but it can annihilate them in the terms of genetics. If we look at Dr. Francis Gresser Welsing's work, and also we look at intellectually, we look at just recently this year alone, I think it was Princeton had its valedictorian. So intellectually, you know, there is a mastering of a phenomenon. You talk about prowess, going to the golf course and can take over. Tiger Woods can go on the tennis court, Venus and Serena Williams, right? So anywhere these people move, they can make some magic happen in some of the most obscure places.
Right, right.
Places. So that is a fear, right? And then think about this. If you've done everything in your power to get rid of a population, if you have beat them, raped them, maimed them, diseased them, and they still exist, you got to ask the question, wait a minute, what else can I do to them? So there is a fear, and there should be a concern. But the concern is not that blacks are out to annihilate whites. It is actually the other way around. And I'll ask you this question. Where do you hear of, where is there a story where there have been a black a mob leaving to go and to wreak havoc on a white community? I have never heard of that conversation. Mm-hmm. So why is it always told about the violence of black people? We engage in violence. A lot of the violence that we engage in is violence against one another. Right. Which we should also talk about as well, right? We have a conversation about how we are attacked by others, but when we carry out their own bidding against ourselves, the idea of so-called black-on-black crime, that's a real challenge as well. But the point is, they have a narrative, and that narrative is that they have identified their open enemy, and their enemy to them are people who are darker than they are, and that the dark has become people of African descent.
So we have become public enemy number one for them.
Exactly.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. So I wanted to ask you, because I try to be, I try to give information, have wonderful, thoughtful, insightful people like you to have conversation with. And I also want to share what are some of the possible solutions. When we think about even this pandemic that we're in, and the narrative was initially black people can't get it, and black people believe that, right? And so we weren't, sheltering in place, we weren't quarantining, we weren't social distancing, and then the rates of hospitalization and death just soared for black and brown people. And so then you hear things like, well, part of the reason is that, we are in an ecosystem of structural racism. And so there are social determinants of health, there are health disparities, there are comorbidities that we overwhelmingly represent, right? And so in this space where we know this information, and we've known this information as it relates to health disparities and the social determinants of health that negatively impact our communities, in 2020, and we come out of this pandemic, what is it that we should be doing differently as a people? I mean, I have a friend, Richard Rowe, who I believe you know as well, and he always says, Jan, no, nobody's coming to save us. We have to save ourselves. So as a people, what would be your thoughts around how our thinking needs to change in relationship to that?
You know, it's you talk about me talking about, and that was a lot in that statement about what is it that we should do differently moving forward as in response to, as a result of this COVID-19 phenomenon. I think that if we look at the topic, right, the concern is if we initially believed that it couldn't happen to Black people, why? Well, part of that came from a conversation that was heard about it is not wreaking havoc in Africa the way it's wreaking havoc other places. So all of a sudden, we became African, right? And so there I am with students in Grambling, and they're saying, hey, you know, we can't get it. And it's like, no, hold on. That's not a true statement because we don't know what it is.
Right.
And then the other issue is that how convenient it is for now all of us to become African, right? So now we run from Africa, but now we're running towards it because we can't get it. The reality is that our lifestyle is not that of those in Africa, right? So we have to be clear about the narrative. And so people begin to believe that conversation, then begin to believe that it was only for older people and believe that all of the things that came out. And so people wanted to, the Afro folks wanted to hang out. So we saw what happened down in Miami. And so the issue is that we begin to believe a lie. What I wanted to suggest a part of this conversation is let's look at what's happening. Let's deal more with the concerns. Is that we are dying in this country from preventable diseases such as obesity, such as coronary heart disease, such as diabetes, right? So we had hypertension. We're dying from these things, and a large part of them have their nexus, or they connect with people surviving the stresses of racism and oppression. And so we must catch that there is a connection, that as the body tries to adjust to this particular stress, as I mentioned earlier about the mice and the shock, there's a shock of being oppressed that creates a condition of fight or flight within the body. Adrenaline increases, trying to engage in fighting and how to get some peace or stability in one's life. And then after that stays for a long time, adrenaline has to be burned off. If it's not, other things happen because cortisol is increased in the bloodstream. Cortisol causes plaque to occur in the arteries. This plaque then causes the heart to have to work harder, high blood pressure. Over a period of time, there's blockage, there's coronary heart disease, and it came from surviving the stresses of racism and oppression. Ooh. And so we see that the same population that has those pre-existing conditions is also the population that is suffering the most from COVID-19. And the question becomes why? And the issue is that there is a condition of vulnerability to any particular disease because of the oppression. Then there's a conversation, Sister Janice, they say that get back to work. Well, if this population that is deemed to be the essential workers
right
in a
now
community,
we're essential.
And yet we've been despised, and get back to work. And we know that it is, for example, in Chicago, 70% of those that have died from it, and also Louisiana, the same similar numbers, 70%, where they make up 12-13% of the entire population of that particular region. We see that if that is happening, when they say get back to work, the question becomes, is this another form of genocide for a population? Because we know that it's, you know, it can take them out. So we have to be critical. And so the question becomes, you say, what do we have to do? We have to be able to analyze the big picture. I think that we get so stuck on small portions. Mm-hmm. It can't hurt us. The issue is, if we're dying from it, if we're dying from so many other things, then what is it that we need to do differently to create a whole new reality? That was your question. And that is to analyze the picture in totality. Don't bifurcate. Don't take a piece of it. Look at the big picture and begin to see what's happening. We're not taking care of our physical health. Why? Right. Because we have a faulty belief system about who we are as a people. And so we don't believe that we have worth and value. People have gone out and started having these parties and stuff. Why? Because I don't have anything to live for. I almost cursed at that point, but I don't have anything to live for, right? So if I don't have anything to live for, then I might as well just go out anyway. But the point is, we have a lot to live for, right? And we have to go back and readjust our thinking and say that, who are we? What is our value in the world? What is our value to our family? What is our value to those that came before us? What is our value to those that come after us? what will we do to create a new reality and not simply beg somebody for something, but how can we begin to do for ourselves? How can we eat differently? Well, we can grow our own food or we can have that option take place. What else can we engage in? Well, can we begin to produce things that affirm our reality? Here's a critical point right here I wanted to throw out. I'm seeing parents on videos talking about, I'm sick and tired of these kids. And people are laughing and making mockery of folks who are talking about they're tired of their children. This is a time where our children have been pulled out of schools, where they have been conditioned to see themselves as being inferior. We have an opportunity to re-infuse them with content about their value and worth.
That's right.
Pull them out of the systems that are annihilating them mentally, causing menticide, and then give them some content about who they are as a people historically and how who they are in this right now moment, this contemporary context. This is a powerful moment.